Hi, my name is Sarah Ash, and I'm a reporter-producer for the Texas Standard. I usually would not call myself a sports fan, but I grew up watching soccer. One of my favorite stories I've reported looked at how women's soccer specifically is growing in popularity in Texas and across the country. Listen anytime to the Texas Standard wherever you get your podcasts.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
It's time for a healthy breakfast.
The number one chocolate.
Or two pizzas for the price of one.
A taste so wonderfully fresh.
When I talk to people about certain peppers, it's very much like a secret club.
I'd say the Chimayo pepper of northern Mexico.
It's a little shriveled up chipotle pepper called Morita.
It was a Halloween thing, yeah. Right? It was ghost pepper Halloween chips.
Yeah.
And my God, I know this is a podcast, but even on a podcast, I can't really explain what that did.
Thanks for joining us for The Secret Ingredient, a podcast produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas, that takes you into the depths of food history and production. We won't tell you what to eat, but we can tell you why you're eating it. For KUT, I'm Rebecca McEnroy.
I am Tom Philpott, food and agriculture writer for Mother Jones Magazine.
And I'm Raj Patel, a professor at the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs.
Today, our secret ingredient is chili peppers. We'll talk with the hot pepper man himself, Gary Nabhan, author of Chasing Chilies, Hot Spots Along the Pepper Trail. Stay with us as we talk about everything from climate change to peppers and masculinity, plus so much more. This is The Secret Ingredient, produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas. Why would we be talking about peppers? Like, what's at stake with peppers? Who really cares?
I like peppers. Let me just put it out there that peppers matter to me.
But for medicinal purposes? Because you're like, oh, the Syrah, yeah, I'm sick.
Occasionally I like
and
my
have...
bowels purged. but also because they're this sort of bellwether of everything from climate change to biodiversity. Plus they add flavor. It's one of the things that white people eat to try and be more like people of color, and it always makes me feel mighty that I can that it was part of my culture growing up. But I think it's just to care about and have an opinion about peppers beyond the sort of Schofield index of how hot things are is to open yourself up to a world where what matters is the culture in which a pepper can feature, and the kind of climate and the growing conditions in which in which allow peppers to thrive. And I think what's interesting about Gary is that he has the kind of big brain that can stitch together both the kind of ethnobotanical story about where peppers come from and the long histories of peppers, but also think about cultivation and think about things as big as climate change and capitalism.
And another thing that I think is really interesting about them is that they've really entered American food. They're really become a big part of U.S. food. We have salsa, which are sort of spiced up with peppers, and they we've got a famous restaurant chain that's now struggling called Chipotle, which is a famous Mexican chili pepper. And one of the things that is at stake here with this is that as this food moves into and becomes a sort of American mainstream item, that the cultivation of it has been transformed. Mm-hmm. And let me just give a quick example. And that is that there's a Mexican seed company called Seminis that cultivated seeds, vegetable seeds, and came up in the 80s and 90s and became a rather large company in Mexico and went international. And the owner of the company decided that if he was going to take his company global, he needed to have a very accessible hot pepper. And so he set to work on breeding peppers like jalapenos and serranos that have become very famous in the United States to have less heat to them. And so he developed these whole lines, and Monsanto bought Seminis sometime
2005,
in 2005. Yeah. And now it is the biggest vegetable seed company in the world. And it presents this vision of what the pepper is that's very different from what Gary presents. It presents this sort of monolithic, uniform, you know, accessible to the most amount of people kind of vision of pepper agriculture. And what Gary is doing in his work, both in the U.S.-Mexico border down in Arizona, but also in his work in the Middle East, in Lebanon, and in Syria, is he's identifying old breeds of peppers that have become very entwined in particular cultures over long amounts of time that are now under threat from climate change. And to hear this sort of Monsanto exec tell it, that stuff doesn't really matter because we've got these very hardy seeds that we can grow mass quantities of that will produce this sort of very uniform and palatable pepper. It won't be too spicy. And I think that is sort of the counter vision to what Gary is doing. And without that kind of work happening, then Monsanto wins and you get this sort of uniform pepper vision.
As soon as we started talking about it, I was thinking to myself, yeah, but how hot can you take your peppers for real? You know what I mean? And just thinking about this question, we're talking about peppers and thinking about like, that is a mark of something. A mark of your authenticity, your relationship to, you know, how virile you are, how whatever it is, you have this relationship. We have this relationship to peppers that's kind of like, I can take them hotter than you, or I can eat this habanero pepper, or I can survive this. And the funny thing is that when you open this market and you say you kind of whitewash it and take away the hotness value and make it mainstream, what do you do to those conversations? You know, you kind of just take the masculinity.
Yeah, how are we expected to perform?
You emasculate.
How are we expected to perform gender?
Exactly.
To perform male gender with how these sort of like limp, you know, not.
That's right.
Not very spicy.
You've got all this
chili
toilet
peppers.
Paper in the freezer for no reason now. I keep coming back to that. Well, no, but
it's really amazing. Ghost, I never knew that trick.
You know, after I bought a bag of ghost pepper. Yeah. What are these? It was a Halloween thing, yeah. Right? It was ghost pepper Halloween chips.
Yeah.
And my God, I know this is a podcast, but even on a podcast, I can't really explain what that did. Point being that. The idea of, you know, basically now that these chilies are collapsed into the dimension of how hot is it or how pretty is it and how uniform is it, and those dimensions of uniformity are just about, is it this kind of uniform red color or is it, you know, how precisely can we tell you how hot it's going to be, as opposed to appreciating that actually peppers have this just amazing range of flavors, and in order for that to happen, you need to grow them in soil, not in the hoop houses that one might want to. And all of a sudden, the way that peppers get to taste and get to taste in a rich, which is a huge span of different kinds of ranges of bitterness and of sweetness and of saltiness. I mean, it's just all there, and all of that disappears under the industrialization of the pepper.
And then when you think about Raj's remarkable statement about toilet paper in the freezer,
yes.
if you're
slow burn one that way.
If you're breeding peppers specifically to ramp down their heat, I also want to wonder what else you're sacrificing. Like, what is in that hot chili pepper that this seed company that got bought by Monsanto, when they ramp that down, what else are they ramping down? What nutrients are they ramping down? What other parts of the food? Because we have, as a culture, there's a bit of fear of spice, right?
Well, this would be white people's culture.
That's it. I mean, that's totally it. It's like, that is a very white thing. Because when you think about ethnicity and somebody says, oh, let's spice it up, or like, let's, you know, add some flavor to it. Typically, they're talking about adding color, adding people of color. Right.
Well,
now.
No, but just to bring that full circle, of course, you know, the one of the important industrial uses of that spice, the key ingredient is capsaicin, which is that's used in pepper spray. So you know, it comes full circle.
Yeah.
To be sprayed in the eyes of protesters around the world. Uh-huh. And I think that there's the big themes of the secret ingredient are capitalism, colonialism, and death. But of course, you have to bring in the police at some point. And I don't know, the idea of the industrial use of this spiciness as being the thing that you put into the eyes of people who are standing up against against state power, I think is just that's just the final insult.
So today's show is about chili peppers, and we have with us today Gary Nabhan. Gary is the author of many books, including Chasing Chilies, about the sort of hot pepper trail in the United States, tracing it from New Mexico through Louisiana and all the way down to Yucatan, Mexico. He has also written about chili peppers in the Middle East, and we're very glad to have you on the show. And Gary, why don't you start us off by talking us through where chilies first got cultivated, how they first came into the human diet, and let's just start there.
Well, I'm in love with chili peppers and use any excuse to write about them or talk with others about them. And why that is that they're the most popular spice or condiment in the world, but they're also a vegetable, a medicine, treatment for cancer and cholesterol, and deeply rooted in our culture, both in the old world and the new world. I think what has been exciting for me has been working with a team from Mexico, the U.S., and Belgium the last few years on tracing the origin of chilies back to a place in Puebla and Oaxaca, Mexico, in the transvolcanic belt where the Sierra Madre corridors come together. And we've used linguistic and genetic and archaeological and biogeographic evidence to determine not only where chilies originated, but what cultures were probably the first cultivators of them over 5,000 years ago.
So, Gary, one of the joys of reading your work is that you're not only an enthusiast about plants, but precisely that relation between the human, the plant, the biological, and the sort of spiritual world. And I'm going to ask you a few questions about that later on. But for now, I mean, just thinking about your sort of odyssey on the hot spots on the pepper trail, I wonder if you can talk about the link between peppers and climate change, which seemed I was surprised that was the direction that you were going to take your study of peppers. And I wonder why you did that and what you can tell us about it.
Well, thank you for that great question, Raj. I've been interested in how widespread species have been diversified by indigenous and peasant farmers around the world into locally adapted ecotypes or land races, what Americans call heirloom or heritage varieties, and how those are very tightly adapted to a particular place and even to a particular habitat and culture. But that very adaptation makes them vulnerable to climate change. So we have the paradox that there's enormous interest in preserving heirloom vegetables now everywhere in the world, really, and yet because they're so well adapted to particular conditions in particular habitats around the world, they're extremely vulnerable to how climate change is shifting temperature and rainfall patterns, as well as pest diseases and predators. And so we have this really interesting paradox that you'd think that being well adapted to your place would be a great asset, and yet it's also a vulnerability that peasant cultures, agrarian cultures around the world are struggling with, because they don't want to lose their favorite peppers, yet they have to adapt their growing conditions to fit the plant's requirements, and those growing conditions are very much being changed by catastrophic climatic events.
And when you were researching that, what most surprised you? Presumably you understood the sort of general thrust of how climate change was altering the environment and the ecology in which these peppers were grown. But was there anything on the trail that most took you by surprise?
Well, I was surprised in a number of ways. And in this case, what struck me the most is that farmers were deeply concerned about how introduced pests and diseases were affecting their crops. They know how to adapt to some extent, to drought and water scarcity and temperature ranges. But when a new pest or disease ends up on your doorstep or in your garden or field for the first time and you have no information about it, your traditional ecological knowledge that most farmers anywhere in the world have distilled and carried with them is disoriented, at least temporarily, and then they begin to use their problem-solving skills to figure out ways to deal with these new pests and diseases. So in the literature that most Americans read on climate change, scientists are telling us about how icebergs and glaciers are more rapidly melting, how we can expect heat waves more frequently in the summer and catastrophic storms like hurricanes. But farmers are not only noticing but are deeply affected by the pests and diseases that are suddenly coming into their fields and gardens.
Gary, I wanted to get an update from you, and that is in 2010, when I was food editor at Grist, you wrote a great piece for me on Aleppo pepper and being under threat from climate change and other forces. And Aleppo, of course, being a part of Syria, and having been in the past couple of years a site of the various, you know, the civil war in Syria, I wonder if you can tell me how Aleppo pepper is faring through all of that. And just so people know, it's an incredible condiment. It's not too spicy, but it's sort of this rich red dried pepper that you can sprinkle on food before you cook it, sprinkle on food after it's done, and it just adds this kind of slightly smoky, slightly sweet, a little bit of extra spice to food that I just love, and was heartbroken to hear about its trouble.
Well, thanks, Tom, for remembering that article and the story behind it. Both Aleppo peppers in Syria and the Urfa pepper in Turkey have been dramatically affected by the internecine conflict in Syria that is, of course, spilled over for dramatic consequences in Turkey and Lebanon as well. So Aleppo peppers and, to a lesser extent, Urfa peppers are still sold in the United States and in Europe well beyond their natural range. But it's, from what I understand, most of that production was yield stockpiled before the conflicts grew so great. One commentary to that Grist article pointed out something that I think was valid, that it was not just climate change directly that was affecting the decline of Aleppo and Urfa peppers near the Turkey-Syria border, but also water politics of denying what you and I would call water justice issues powerful constituencies were keeping water from reaching peasant farming areas, including those of the farmers who grew Urfa peppers and Aleppo peppers for local consumption and export, as a way to sort of control and degrade living conditions for the farmers themselves. So it was not just directly drought that was affecting that area, but also the withholding of irrigation water. And, of course, the whole Aleppo market, that was one of the last places in the world, that the area around the market where Jews and Muslims and Christians worshipped at the same place, has been completely destroyed. And I don't think we see any resolution to that tragedy in the near future. The valley where my family's from in Lebanon now has 4 Syrians for every Lebanese resident, and I doubt whether most of them had the capacity to take their Aleppo chili seeds along with them before they had to flee Syria.
Right.
So it's a enormous tragedy and many dimensions to it that we can't discuss here.
Chili peppers seem to me as incredibly resilient plants and also incredibly diverse. There's so many different kinds of chili peppers. So it seems like a foodstuff that will probably do pretty well in climate change. Am I right? Can you talk about that?
Chili peppers as a whole will do incredibly well in climate change as long as we continue to exchange seeds between one another without corporate intervention that is controlling intellectual property rights of those seeds. And so the key thing is maintaining reciprocal and voluntary access to chili resources. But if you've selected a variety that does relatively well compared to the soils and the prevailing pests and microbes in your area, Tom. So I think these themes of resilience and diversity that run through my own work and both of your work have larger messages to tell us about how we can all survive and thrive in a rapidly changing world.
One of the other things that is also a strand in your work, Gary, is the idea of knowledge exchange. I mean, that's sort of where we began, where you're saying, look, climate change isn't just about weather changing. Farmers get that, but what they don't get is that they don't necessarily have the knowledge to confront and to manage these new pests and these new sort of biological threats. But the idea of knowledge exchange, in addition to seeds, I mean, seeds are fine, but you also need to know what to do with them, and you need to be able to exchange the knowledge and the culture that goes with them. What examples of that are you encouraged by?
Well, first of all, that's such a great point that we need to remind ourselves of all the time. Where I am infatuated by seeds, frankly, I still see the traditional knowledge associated with them as more valuable and perhaps more at risk than the seeds themselves. We only need to go back to the story of pellagra reaching the south to remember that it's not just corn seed, but the traditional knowledge or lack of it that affects whether a plant can nourish us or not or cause diseases. And so it's not the crops themselves, but the cultural connections with them that allow them to nourish us.
Well, so in terms of those cultural connections, are you seeing them being made in ways that make you optimistic about being able to fight climate change?
I believe so. For instance, there's some rare potatoes grown from the Monterey Peninsula in California up to Sitka, Alaska, that were introduced by the Spanish directly from Chile and Peru rather than from the smaller gene pool of potatoes that went to Europe and then came back to the New World. And I have been involved with their conservation and promotion through slow food chapters in the Pacific Northwest. And when I talked about the successes there in Sitka, Alaska one time, a Tlingit woman came up and she said, well, my family has one of those potatoes, and we want to try to figure out a way to share it with other indigenous peoples in Alaska and Canada who live inland because sea level rising is affecting our potato ground. So now it's being grown inland in Alaska through an intercultural exchange that then provides some of the potatoes back to the Tlingits on the coast. So this kind of thing where the climate change geographers call assisted migration has been talked about for endangered species of birds or reptiles or orchids, where we intentionally move them out of harm of climate change. But it's kind of a clunky idea for wild species, but an excellent idea for willing cultural exchanges among kindred people. And so the idea of food sovereignty is not to control every food intellectually and economically the way a Monsanto or a Bayer Crop Science or a Sementis might look at it, but it's to make wise decisions about who you voluntarily share those resources with. In a broad sense, it's more about whether the original caretakers remain in control and in reciprocity with the people with whom they share those resources.
I have a question kind of along those lines, but from a different perspective about peppers, because I think that when I talk to people about certain peppers or certain peppers I've used in recipes or when I've had a certain dish with certain peppers. It's very much like a secret club, like a little, you know, secret society of people talking about these peppers. And I wondered if you might have any stories about these types of exchanges that you've had with people about the way that peppers are used and the recipes they're used in and certain peppers they've eaten or tried or, you know, had an experience with.
Well, yes. I mean, one that strikes me is in the Chasing Chilies book with my colleagues Kurt Fries and Craig Kraft. And that's that we were very interested in hearing that an African-American tradition around chili pepper found between Baltimore and Philadelphia had somehow been maintained and was being revitalized. And an African-American historian named Michael, forgive me because of my concussion, I can't remember his last name, had really done some interesting research on this. And it was that the pepper was likely introduced during the Thomas Jefferson era, but Michael was able to trace back the chain of events linguistically about how this particular fish pepper was related to African sauces, which were a terrific way to accommodate the flavor and texture of this pepper, very different from Mexican-American salsas or Northern European sauces. And other people who had not been exposed to the pili-pili tradition and Berberet sauces of North Africa couldn't quite figure out how to use it. And so there's whole networks of people, informal networks, that explore these things today, just like those African-American crab shack short order cooks figured this out. And it was really not the elite like Thomas Jefferson that kept this chili pepper and its distinctive uses in these sauces going, but the lowest paid people in the Baltimore and Philadelphia economies, the short order cooks in these crab shacks.
Yeah, so I was just wondering, I just had a quick question about whether hotter weather makes for hotter chilies.
That's a great question, Tom. In essence, it's a combination of hotter weather and the hot, dry winds that come with that weather in many places that increase the pungency of chilies. So where I am on the U.S.-Mexico border, the very same chili variety might be twice as hot in a summer-fall regime where hot, dry winds hit in August and September right as the chilies are finishing ripening. And what happens is that bell-like characteristic of chilies, the tissue that we call carpal tissue inside the chili that makes those little partitions is where all the hotness is. And in this hot, dry weather, the resins that carry capsaicin, the pungency principle in chilies. When the chilies shake on the plant, that spreads the pungency throughout the fleshy tissue of the plant and makes them much hotter.
Well, and Gary, you have written a book called Why Some Like It Hot. Why do some people? My first interaction with chili was when my grandmother was munching away on these tiny, incredibly powerfully hot green chilies, and you know, I couldn't look at it without breaking a sweat, and she was just chewing on them like they were toothpicks. And so I'm wondering, I mean, why is it that some food cultures have really embraced this food and others haven't?
To make a long story short, different cultures and their genetic populations around the world vary in their sensitivity to pungency and bitterness. The same thing happens with animals. Mammals are hypertasters of pungency and avoid anything pungent, where birds don't taste them at all. Hmm. In essence, what is most interesting to me is that there's a certain degree of acclimation or learned behavior to be able to tolerate hotter and hotter chilies, but it's bracketed by your genetic predisposition to hot and bitter foods. There's a great number of spicy foods, not just chilies, that break people out into a sweat and cool them off and reduce microbial damage in meats if they're put into a curry sauce or whatever, that the chilies and other spices have an antimicrobial effect that's more important in hot climate.
Oh, so I've got this all wrong, haven't I? Because I'm thinking my grandma can munch on these chilies and she doesn't break into a sweat and she's fine, and I break into a sweat and there's something wrong with me. But in fact, what you're saying is the sweat is actually part of some sort of interaction with a hot environment, where eating chilies helps you keep cool, and that's one of the reasons to do it.
That's right. So I don't have any direct answer to compare you and your grandmother, but that's just a guess.
Gary, I have a question. It's a selfish one because I have to know how to do this. But how, if you get hot chilies on your hands, and the seeds inside on your hands, and your hands are burning, or any part of your body is burning, what's the best way to get rid of that and cool that off?
Well, there's two things that I think of, and one is that washing with soap or other chemicals that take off the resins that carry the pungency principle can immediately reduce that. So, washing your hands with soap. Certain doughs, people say that when your throat is hot, to eating a bread or bread dough helps, and Mexican friends of mine say that they grew up eating masa or corn tortillas to do the same thing. And I think the main rule we have is one of etiquette to the people we live with and love, is never touch your lover with hands that have been handling chilies all day long.
Or yourself.
Or yourself.
So to speak.
I have another question. I wondered about this kind of special space that peppers fill in the mythology of how we understand their presence in the food chain. And even just thinking about ghost peppers and what those represent. You know, I just wanted you to talk a little bit about the mythology of peppers.
Well, that's great. Peppers were used ritually and as a vermifuge, and almost like frankincense and other plants were used in the old world to sort of freshen the air and clear the air before they were used as a vegetable. They had ceremonial significance. They're in the origin myths of the Huichol people. And my former neighbor, the famous integrative medicine expert, Dr. Andrew Weil calls chili peppers a psychotropic plant. In other words, it's a mind-altering drug. It's not a hallucinogen, but it clearly changes enough physiological processes in your body, and particularly in your brain, that your receptivity to sensory inputs and phenomena around you shifts. So to say that chili peppers is a psychotropic drug would be like saying nettles, truffles, or a whole number of other herbs and plants and fungi can affect your behavior and your perception without giving you hallucinations. And I think indigenous cultures picked up on this very early in their exposure to different kinds of chili peppers. The ghost pepper is just on another level, of course, because it can be a life or death altering drug. I mean, when they started offering it in a San Antonio cafe a few years ago, I think something like 1 in 10 customers who ate whole ghost peppers had to be rushed into the hospital. So that's a little bit of life alteration for you.
So, Gary, of all the chili peppers, the entire variety that you know, from the Middle East to Mexico to the American Southwest through Louisiana, et cetera, et cetera, if you had to choose one chili pepper to eat, what would it be? And what is your favorite sort of chili-centric dish?
Okay, well, I am like a romantic who is smitten by every wondrous thing that passes him by. And so I can't choose a single pepper. I'd say the Chimayo pepper of northern Mexico, the Chile Colban of highland Guatemala, and the Aleppo pepper there's ways that people process it with all three that give it this smoky, rich flavor that, regardless of the heat, comes through in a remarkable way. Sometimes it's not smoke as much as it's juxtaposition with rock salt that brings out something in chili peppers that three cultures independently have come upon. And then I have to say, I was just down in Oaxaca with some wonderful ethnobotanists last fall, and the seven moles of Oaxaca, I think, are one of the highest achievements of cuisines anywhere. And I argue in my recent book from University of California Press, Cumin Camels and Caravans, that's because it's taking some culinary techniques and principles that emerged in the world in Persia and spread through the Arabian Peninsula to North Africa and into Spain, that then came into the New World, that the moles of Oaxaca and Puebla, Mexico, are the perfect distillation and expression of the convergence of old world Mediterranean cooking techniques accommodating new world spices like chili peppers and achiote and other minor ingredients like wild oreganos.
We really appreciate you talking with us, Gary. This has been such a pleasure. Thank you.
I think it's a risk on your part to get someone as sort of Tourette's about chili peppers. Anyway, thank you all for your great work.
That's really lovely of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Gary.
Take care.
Keep in touch.
Gary Nabhan is the W.K. Kellogg Endowed Chair in Sustainable Food Systems at the University of Arizona's Southwest Center and author of Chasing Chilies, Hot Spots Along the Pepper Trail. You can find out more about Gary and his work to build a more just, nutritious, sustainable, and climate-resilient food shed spanning the U.S.-Mexico border at his website, GaryNabhan.com. You've been listening to The Secret Ingredient with Raj Patel, Tom Philpott, and me, Rebecca McEnroy. On our last episode, I said that the next episode would be an interview with Dr. Glenn Stone about golden rice, but we did peppers instead. So our next episode, we will talk with anthropologist Dr. Glenn Stone about the incredibly misunderstood world of golden rice, how this wonder crop fell from grace and cast dark shadows on conversations about child nutrition and equality. Also, make sure you never miss a show. Subscribe to The Secret Ingredient in iTunes or on SoundCloud, and please leave us a review. We'd love to know what you think of the show. The Secret Ingredient is engineered by David Alvarez and produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas.
What is your favorite pepper? Does anyone have one?
I have one, and you're going to be like, you lame ass, because it's the serrano. But I love it.
It's good pepper.
I love serranos.
It's a good solid pepper.
You know?
Right?
I love chipotle. I mean, I just like that just smoke. I like the smoke.
Yeah, that is nice.
So I'm going to name a pepper that is a subset of chipotles. Mm-hmm. It's the chile morita. Morita. Ooh. And it's a small... So the chipotle comes from the jalapeno mm-hmm. pepper. It's a smoked dried jalapeno. The morita comes from some smaller pepper. It might even be serrano. I'm not sure. But it's a little shriveled up chipotle pepper called morita that they don't sell in adobo. They don't sell it in cans. You can only get it dried. And it's spicier and smokier. And it's just got a great texture. And I use them every chance I get. They're a little hard to get in the United States. You can get them at a place like Fiesta Market that caters to a Latin American community. And I bring them back from Mexico every chance I get.
Oh, my God. So, okay, another quick pepper question. So what's your favorite way, or how do you prepare peppers? What's your favorite way to prepare and eat peppers?
Roast and peel, or with dried chili peppers. I have a real thing for dried chili peppers, but I love fresh ones as well. But toast the dried chili peppers and then soak in water and then do whatever else you're going to do.
When you toast them, you like put them in a toaster oven?
No, I put them on a hot skillet, hot dry skillet, no oil, uh-huh. and sort of press them down and then turn them over and get the other side just for 15 or 20 seconds.
Nice. Okay. And then you put them under water.
And then I'll rehydrate them with some hot water.
Why do you do that?
Because they're so hard and dry. Mm-hmm. You know, they're so kind of tough. But I'm going into the weeds here, but I do have a salsa where I don't do that. And it's called salsa matcha, which is a big thing in southern Mexico. And it's dried chilies. Morita is a classic one. You take them, toast them, kind of cut them up with scissors into smaller pieces, and puree them in a blender with a little garlic and a little oil. And you get this sort of chunky paste of pepper. And then you also create this pepper oil. And I put it on everything. And when I first make it, I have problems like Raj is alluding to, because I overuse it. I'll go a couple weeks without it, and then I'll make more of it. And salsa matcha.
It's gorgeous.
Great stuff.
Oh, my God. And you, Raj?
Well, I mean, oddly, of course, I mean, chilies are these new world phenomenon. And so they were brought into Indian food fairly recently, I mean, you know, in historical time. But there's still this sort of fantastic version of just cheese on toast with chilies on, and it's just serranos on. It's just it's my comfort food. I have it from when I was younger, and you know, my mom used to make these just regular melted cheese sandwiches, but with the chilies on, and all of a sudden it's so lovely. It just gives cheese on toast the flavor that cheese on toast really wants.
That's gorgeous.
And we have that in the form of quesadillas here in Texas.
Oh, yeah.
When you grew up in Texas.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But cheese on toast, oh, my God.
That sounds great. That's
it's
just so simple.
Where do you put the Marmite then?
Underneath the cheese.
Okay, good. Yeah, just wondering.
Do brain games really make me smarter? What is all this screen time doing to my brain? How do I protect my brain as I age? Find the answers to life's most and least pressing questions about your mind with the Two Guys on Your Head podcast. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts.